Hi, I'm Ashley Flowers, creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. Every Monday, me and my best friend Britt break down a new case, but not in the way you've heard before, and not the cases you've heard before. You'll hear stories on Crime Junkie that haven't been told anywhere else. I'll tell you what you can do to help victims and their families get justice. Join us for new episodes of Crime Junkie every Monday, already waiting for you by searching for Crime Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to Red Handed, where today we're going somewhere we haven't been in a while, if ever.
Yeah, we have.
We probably have.
And physically with our bodies.
Physically. So actually, I have a very interesting story. When Hannah and I went to Finland, yes, that's where we're going today, for our European tour, this time last year, actually.
God, is that it?
Yeah, this time Jesus. Last year. We were obviously, you know, we went to Ireland, we went to Norway, we went to Sweden, we went to Finland, and then we did like a full UK tour. It was fantastic. When we were in Finland, we were going through like immigration. Do you remember that the immigration guy who I got like was like, what do you do?
Oh, yeah.
What is this? He was like quite like curt about it. And then I was like, hey, I have a true crime podcast. Please let me into your country. And he was like, And then he started writing something down on a piece of paper. And I was like, my God, what is happening? And then he handed me the piece of paper and my passport. And he was like, okay, thanks. And he was like, those are some cases I would like you to cover. And I was like, that is so fucking cool. And the top of the list was this particular case.
Well, there you go.
So if you are Finnish, you already know what case is. Well, if you're not, you've already fucking read it. But let me tell you, it is, of course, the Ulvila case. I've been practicing saying that, but that's as good as it's going to get because we are going to butcher some Finnish names today.
Sounded pretty Finnish to me.
Thank you very much.
And I know because everyone, apparently I look quite Finnish.
Oh, well, there you
go. So when we were in Helsinki, everyone spoke to me in Finnish. And I was like, I am so sorry. I am but a moron.
I don't know. I don't speak Finnish. I don't think that's a slight on your intelligence, my friend.
Best breakfast we had, though, I thought.
It was delicious.
Yeah.
It was great. Do you know what? I'm still on the top of my list to get myself some freeze-dried sea buckthorn berries because they were delicious.
If I ever eventually decide that I'm going to learn to ski, I'll do it in Finland.
There you go. So let's get on with it. We've got a big case ahead of us and, you know, we've got some name butchery to get on with. It was 3 a.m. on the 1st of December 2006 when Finnish emergency services received a call. There's a killer. Come quickly. Someone came in through the window and stabbed my husband. I'm bleeding too. Come quickly. The caller was 41-year-old Anneli Owa, who lived in the small town of Ulvila in southern Finland. The phone call lasted approximately 4 minutes, and Anneli's 55-year-old husband, Jukka Lähti, could be heard screaming for help in the background. Anneli said that the attacker had broken in through the terrace door of their bedroom and was stabbing Jukka to death as she spoke. At one point, Anneli gave the phone to her eldest daughter, 9-year-old Amanda, as she ran to see what was happening to Jukka, who, according to her, was still being savaged. When Amanda has the phone, she also tells the operator, "Come quickly, my dad is hurt. Daddy, don't die." Anneli then returned to the phone 60 seconds later and explains that the intruder had stabbed her when she went back into the bedroom before going back to attacking her husband, Jukka. Little Amanda, now off the phone, rushed back to see her father and at this point witnessed the intruder climbing out of the bedroom window and her father laying on the floor covered in blood. From this harrowing call, a bunch of messy, tainted evidence and the wild testimony of traumatized children, this case swelled to become one of the most notorious murders ever in Finnish history. Judicial madness, police fuck-ups, greed, undercover lovers, satanic child abuse rituals, DNA mix-ups, a family destroyed, and a murder mystery that divided a nation.
Bingo!
That's what we've got for you today. This case is bonkers. Or as the Finns would say, hulu. So let's get into it.
Police and paramedics arrived at the house 9 minutes after the call was made, and Jukkalati was pronounced dead at the scene. He'd been stabbed an estimated 88 times, but his cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head. He'd received 2 blows from a heavy object. There were shards of glass and blood everywhere in the bedroom, leading from the terrace door to Yucca's body and back. On the floor next to Yucca was a blood-stained S-shaped knife and a pile of blood-stained logs of firewood. From those logs, police recovered the DNA of an unknown male. They discovered a black glove on the bed, and bloody footprints were found on the terrace outside the window, along with bloody handprints on the window frame. Brown synthetic fibres were also recovered from the window, the terrace, and from Yucca's body. At around 4:30 a.m, about an hour and a half after the murder had occurred, police sniffer dogs arrived on the scene to help track the killer. But the dogs couldn't find or follow a single scent. Possibly because so many officers had already walked in and out of the house. So maybe the dogs were just confused. And I don't know why I think this, but I do think that a Finnish canine unit are probably top of their game.
No one is fucking top of their game in this fucking story, mate. The police are not. They are bottom of every game there is to play. They're bottom of fucking tiddlywinks. This is terrible. But the police dog thing does come back into the story later, so it's important to mention the fact that they don't pick up a scent that leads them outside. But there could be an explanation as to why. So the following day, lying in her hospital bed with a punctured lung, Annalie told police her side of the story. She said that her husband had come home from work at about 11 p.m. and after putting their 4 kids, aged 2, 4, 7, and 9, to bed, Annalie and Yucca also went to sleep. It was around 2:40 a.m. when the sound of shattering glass suddenly woke them. A man dressed in black, wearing a balaclava, smashed the window of their terrace door next to their bed and climbed in. At this point, according to Annalie, the bedroom was still dark, and she and Yucca, terrified, could just about make out the man's silhouette. Yucca jumped up and grabbed 2 pieces of firewood to defend himself as the attacker lunged for him. Annalie tried to help her husband, but when the attacker waved his knife at her, she turned around. She screamed for the children to get out of the house, but they didn't hear. After this, Annalie said that she ran from the bedroom where her husband was being attacked and went to the kitchen to find the landline. While she was on the phone to emergency services was when their eldest daughter, Amanda, had been woken up by the noise and come downstairs. This is when Annalie thrust the phone into the child's hands and staggered back to her bedroom, fearing the worst. And Annalie said that this is when the intruder had attacked her, stabbing her in the chest, puncturing her lung. In the chaos, 9-year-old Amanda ran into her parents' room just in time to see a man climbing out of the window and to see her father's lifeless body on the floor.
It was quickly determined that the killer was likely to be a young man who knew Jukkalati personally. Investigators were sure that this wasn't a random act of violence because it was so violent. The attacker seemed solely interested in Yucca, and that screamed premeditation. After all, the attacker knew exactly which window to enter to find Yucca. As for motive, well, Yucca was a social psychologist and worked in HR management. His job was essentially to fire people, and investigators, now looking into his murder, found that they actually had an ever-expanding list of suspects. It seemed quite a lot of people who knew Yucca didn't like him or the way that he handled things at work, and there were quite a few people who outright hated him. In fact, not long before he was killed, Yucca had let go of 400 employees from a local copper factory. And as a result, he had actually received a number of death threats in the lead up to his murder, all of which he said he reported to the police at the time. Though according to Annalie, she hadn't taken the threats that seriously. She felt that her husband had a tendency to be overdramatic about things. But report the death threats Yucca did. Oddly though, his phone records showed that these threats were logged to a police precinct a few towns away from his own home. But what's even more odd is that everyone at that particular precinct claimed never to have received any such reports of death threats, despite the fact that there was evidence that somebody had searched Yucca's name in the police database from that station.
Now, this case, like we said, is a big one. It's one that is a national obsession in Finland. And because cases like that tend to take on a life of their own, there's lots of conspiracy theories about it. And this is one of those particular ones. Like we said, they're like, we don't know. We never had a record of this, which is odd. But there is kind of a possible explanation for this odd situation. But I have to be fair that it is an explanation that only makes the whole thing weirder. Because we found some sources claiming that the policeman who had taken Yuka's reports about the death threats had himself been found murdered in his own home. So that could be why nobody else at the police station has any memory of these reports. And obviously this guy being killed raises a big red flag, but the police insist that the two killings were completely unrelated. However, this wasn't the only strange connection. An old university friend of Yuka's, who visited him shortly before the murder, was found drowned at sea the day after Yuka's murder. But the police again concluded that this was unrelated and a suicide.
Hi, I'm Ashley Flowers, creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. Every Monday, me and my best friend Britt break down a new case, but not in the way you've heard before, and not the cases you've heard before. You'll hear stories on Crime Junkie that haven't been told anywhere else. I'll tell you what you can do to help victims and their families get justice. Join us for new episodes of Crime Junkie every Monday, already waiting for you by searching for Crime Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts.
After interviewing neighbors, police learned that a red Volvo had been seen circling the streets on the night of the murder and the week before. It was possible that the driver had been scoping out the house. Chief Investigator Juha Jautsenlahti put out an alert to the public to help identify the car and the driver, but they had no luck. What the police did have, however, was DNA. The foreign DNA that they'd found on the firewood that Yuka had used to defend himself. And so what followed was the largest gathering of DNA samples in Finnish criminal history. The National Crime Lab tested the DNA of over 700 people, but they still couldn't find a match. But put a pin in this, a DNA helix spiral pin, because we're going to come back to it.
6 months passed, and the police were under an immense amount of pressure to solve the case. So in the summer of 2007, they arrested a man named Kai Tanner, who just so happened to be a semi-famous Finnish actor and theatre director, and they held him in custody for 7 days. Now, Tanner had already been interviewed back in February after one of Yuka's neighbours mentioned that he had a red car, but that seems a bit weak, but apparently that was enough for them to go and arrest this guy. And then Juha Jousenlahti, the chief investigator, showed Annalie a picture of Kai Tanner. And she mentioned that he did have similar features to the man who had killed her husband. And then Jousenlahti had Annalie pick Tanner out of a lineup, which we've seen this so many times before. She obviously fucking did, because she'd already been shown his photo, which makes him look really bloody guilty. And Annalie picked Tanner out of that lineup, despite the fact that she'd already told police that Tanner was considerably shorter than the man who had attacked her and her husband. Still, Tanner was arrested and held for a week, and only released when his DNA wasn't a match for the sample taken from the murder scene. But again, we'll come back to this.
In the meantime, Tanner managed to get himself €11,000 in compensation for wrongful arrest and a loss of earnings.
This case is going to get very expensive for the Finnish police, who were losing at tiddlywinks.
And now the police were back to square one, and the pressure from the public to solve the murder was mounting, because that's what happens when you put it in the press. The story had by this point become a media sensation, especially after the police dragged an innocent, semi-famous actor into the mix. And as public pressure increased, the tensions within the police were rising too. Many officers weren't happy with the way in which the chief investigator was approaching things. Mostly, they didn't like that he refused to consider Annalie herself, Yuka's wife, as the prime suspect. But the chief insisted that there was no evidence at all that she had killed her husband. He had the recording of the emergency call, the bloody footprints that were too big for her, and proof that the window had been smashed from the outside. And 9-year-old Amanda said that she had seen a man climbing
out of the window.
Yeah, there's just so much evidence, and especially the emergency call, because remember, Annalie is talking on the phone to the operator and they can hear Yuka screaming in the background like he's being attacked. So how is she killing him and also talking to the police? There's an interesting twist in that later, which we'll come to. But at this point, you can't blame the chief investigator for being like, she can't be a suspect. So while yes, when somebody is murdered, it does make sense to suspect the spouse. But in this case, it did seem highly unlikely. Firstly, it would have been very difficult for Annalie to overpower her husband. And it is typically unusual for women to engage in such overkill. It takes a lot of power to stab somebody 88 times. Her hands were also not cut up. If you stab somebody that many times, your hands slipping in the blood and the sheer force needed, your hands would certainly show some damage. In fact, apart from the severe stab wound that had punctured Annalie's lung, she shouldn't have any other wounds. And you would certainly expect to see some wounds if she had been struggling with a man who was fighting for his life. And Annalie was also not covered in Yuka's blood when officers arrived, which if she had stabbed him 88 times, she definitely would have been. Police also didn't find any traces of blood in the laundry room or anywhere else in the house. After searching the property and the surrounding areas thoroughly for bloody t-shirts or anything like that that Annalie may have hidden, they still found nothing. And the police had arrived within minutes of Annalie's phone call, so how could she even have had time to hide or dispose of any bloody clothes anyway? Plus, no one could think of any motive.
Sounds like everyone else in the town has a motive apart from his wife. After 2 years passed with no promising leads, Jussin Lahti decided to pass the case up to Finland's National Bureau of Investigation. But the National Police Commissioner blocked the transfer because he didn't want the public to think that the police were incapable of solving a single premeditated home invasion murder, especially one that it had been concluded early on had been carried out by someone known to the victim.
Yeah, it's pretty much like as slam dunk as it should be.
Yeah.
They also, like, I think people forget, they also had so much stuff. They have the fibres, they have the footprints, they have the handprints. There's not like there was a dearth of evidence, like forensic evidence at the scene of the crime either.
So here's what he did instead. The commissioner removed Jussin Lahti from the case and appointed someone called Pauli Kurisaranta.
Which does make things easier for us, because from now on we can just call him Pauli.
So Pauli becomes chief investigator on the case in 2009. And Pauli, like the rest of the department, was certain that the wife, Annalie, was guilty.
So basically the police commissioner is just like, I don't think you're doing the right thing. And you keep trying to involve the National Bureau of Investigation. You're gone. Here's a guy who already agrees with what we all think. Yeah. He's going to look into it now.
And that's management. So Annalie immediately became the focus of the investigation. For Pauli, there were a few unanswered questions that made Annalie more than likely to have been her husband's killer. Firstly, how the murderer managed to escape even though the police arrived at the scene within 10 minutes of being called. And secondly, why hadn't the dogs been able to pick up a scent that led them out of the house if there had been an intruder?
So the police, hell-bent on finding something that pointed at Annalie, called on psychologist Pirkko Lahti, no relation to Yuka, to analyse the video of Annalie's hospital interview from the morning after the murder. According to Pirkko, Annalie's behaviour amid the crisis was incredibly unusual. He said she was far too calm. It would appear that nobody had informed him that Annalie had been heavily sedated with diazepam at the time. Nor had anybody told him, apparently, that she'd actually been crying hysterically when she arrived at the hospital, no doubt why she was pumped full of diazepam. Regardless, though, Pirkko's statement was exactly what the police wanted to hear. The pressure was now on for Pauli, and he was prepared to take things a lot further than his predecessor. So the first thing he did was have Annalie Auer monitored 24/7. He had her phones tapped, and even her whole house bugged. And he didn't stop there.
One day in March 2009, Annalie was walking her younger daughter to preschool when she noticed a mobile phone on the ground that was ringing. So in quite an odd move, I think, Annalie picked up the phone and answered it. And the man on the other end of the line told her that the phone belonged to his friend and asked if his friend could meet her later on to pick it up. That evening, when the man came to Annalie's house to collect the phone,
He brought a gift card for a spa and a box of chocolates to say thank you. Anneli later noticed that the man, whose name was Seppo Makela, had left his number, an email address, inside the envelope for the gift card. Although she did think that was quite sweet, Anneli didn't reach out. 3 years on, she was still reeling from her husband's murder, as you would be. A few weeks later on the school run, Seppo happened to be jogging past, and he and Anneli stopped for a chat.
No, I'm out. I'm running. I'm jogging away from Seppo. Come on. And like, honestly, when you guys understand exactly what's going on here, the mobile phone on the floor ringing and all of this, it's not funny at all what happens, but the setup for it feels quite comical in my head for how this is made to happen.
Seppo mentioned that he had been hoping Anneli would have called or texted him. And after a few days, Anneli decided, what the hell? So she texted him and the two began speaking regularly.
When Anneli mentioned that she needed to take her car to the mechanic to get a tire changed, Seppo insisted that he'd do it for her. While he was working on the car, he asked Anneli whether she'd like to go to the spa, for which he'd already got her tickets, with him. And she agreed. And it was on this incredibly weird, inappropriate first date to a spa, which is my fucking nightmare idea of a first date, that Seppo made the first move and told Anneli that he had feelings for her. Following this, the two started dating, occasionally going to the movies together. Seppo said that Anneli was the first woman he dated since his divorce 5 years ago, and he really wanted a serious relationship again. And after this, things began to move pretty fast. Seppo invited Anneli and the kids to move in with him, and she was considering it. Anneli had finally started falling in love again, and the kids all really liked Seppo too. But then, Seppo told Anneli that he had read about the case on Wikipedia and had lost sleep over it. He began asking her prying questions about the case, and even whether she was guilty or not. Eventually, Seppo relented and told Anneli, whatever happens, I'll be by your side until the end. But that didn't last long, because on the 2nd of September 2009, Seppo broke up with Anneli by mail. So like, posting her a fucking letter, telling her that he'd fallen into a depression and he had to call it a day.
3 weeks later, on the 28th of September 2009, Anneli was arrested and her children were placed in the care of her brother and his wife. In police custody, Anneli, as I'm sure you can imagine, was questioned relentlessly. All the investigators had was extremely flimsy circumstantial evidence and an even flimsier theory. And eventually, they did reach their time limit for holding Anneli without anything solid, so they had to release her. Still, the police made it clear to Anneli that this was in no way over. They were certain that she was their killer, and they would be going after her with everything they had. She was also not allowed to have any contact with her children, even after she was released. And to make matters worse, her face was on the front page of every Finnish newspaper, dubbing her a murderer. And we can't stress just how big of a case this was in Finland. Every country seems to have one case that the nation is obsessed with, and possibly for us it's Maddie. Well, for Finland, it's Olvila. So imagine when years after the murders, the police point the finger, loudly and publicly, at the victim's own wife.
Anneli didn't sleep for days. When she asked to see her children, the chief inspector proposed a deal. He told Anneli that she could have a meeting with the kids if she could give them any new information about the murder. Anneli would later say that she was put under so much stress and pressure to think of something, anything to tell them, that she began to question what was real and what wasn't. Because the police made it clear, if she didn't come up with something, she might not ever see her children again.
After a week of sleepless nights, Anneli was brought in for questioning once more. The interviewer told her that she had to be the murderer. There was no other plausible explanation. He claimed that the police couldn't find a single piece of evidence of an outside killer. And that is what we call in the industry a big fat whopping lie. And officers went ahead and told this lie, even though the Finnish Criminal Investigations Act forbids lying to suspects. And this whole move is so bizarre because the police had been investigating the murder for years by this stage. And for most of the investigation, they'd been pretty open about the possibility of an outside killer. But now they were suddenly claiming that they were 100% certain that there wasn't one. There never had been one. So interviewers began feeding Annalie a hypothetical scenario that maybe she and her husband Jukka had had an argument that night. And maybe Annalie had lost her temper and stabbed her husband to death. And maybe the reason why she couldn't remember anything was because she was suffering from amnesia. Then they asked Annalie whether she thought that that maybe story was possible. Annalie, stressed and sleep-deprived and probably full of drugs, said that it was possible. She said that it wasn't out of the realm of possibility and that she could be suffering from memory loss. Great, the interviewer thought, and then he had Annalie sign a statement. And although Annalie double-checked with officers that this was simply a hypothetical scenario, they took it as an actual factual confession.
So before she knew it, Annalie was thrown in a cell for pre-trial detention. The police commissioner made a public statement that the crime had been solved. Hooray! Finnish newspapers began running the story that Annalie had confessed to murdering her husband and staging the entire crime scene. The investigative team even celebrated by going on a cruise together. Which seems fucking mental. They haven't even got a conviction yet. So Annalie made it clear to her lawyer that she had not confessed, but it was too late. Her murder trial was set for April 2010. And the prosecution's version of events went as follows. On the night in question, Annalie and Jukka had had an argument, which led to a physical altercation, and Jukka had actually stabbed Annalie first, because they've got to explain how she's got that punctured lung. Then they say that Annalie had managed to get the knife off him and stabbed Jukka in the armpit, causing him to bleed out and fall unconscious. She then assumed he was dead, staged the scene as a break-in, smashed the terrace door window in their bedroom from the outside, and even made the bloody footprints. Obviously, they're ignoring here the fact that Jukka didn't die of a stab wound or from bleeding to death. He died of blunt force trauma. So she stabs him in the armpit and then smashes him in the head for good measure. That kills him. And then she also stabs him 88 times. They kind of like just brush over all of that. And also in the prosecution's version of events, Annalie then phoned emergency services, but Jukka woke up halfway through, at which point she handed 9-year-old Amanda the phone. And that's why you can hear him screaming in the background. And then she hit Jukka over the head to finish the job and then stabbed him 88 times, just to be really sure.
In front of her 9-year-old daughter.
Who also saw a man climbing out the window.
The defence pointed out that this would have meant that Annalie had somehow eradicated every speck of blood from the living room before the police arrived 10 minutes after she picked up the phone. Because the only traces of blood that were discovered led to and away from the broken terrace door and footprints outside. This story also would have meant that Annalie changed clothes and hid her bloody clothes so well that they would never be found by investigators or the dogs that they brought. And the same goes for the blunt object that was used to kill Jukka as well, which was never found. And, as Saru said, she managed to stab him another 87 times.
And her hands are fine, again.
And she herself gets stabbed, and her lung gets punctured, and that all happens in 10 minutes.
Yeah, so under the prosecution's version of events, like, she gets stabbed first. So she's done all of this, staging the crime scene, stabbing her husband that many times, knocking him over the head, calling emergency services, all with a punctured lung. Sure.
It made no sense. But somehow the police and prosecution seemed to have been able to twist the situation into saying that they didn't know exactly how Annalie may have pulled it off, but that there was no evidence of an outsider in the house, which meant that she was the only viable suspect, because it couldn't have been one of the children. This is obviously insane that they would argue this. We've said it before and we will say it again. The absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So just because they couldn't find hard evidence of an intruder doesn't mean that we can say there was absolutely no third party in that house on that night.
It's shocking to me that they're able to just say that.
Yeah.
Like, who would allow that to be said? It's mad.
It is.
So also, Amanda, like we said, has insisted since the day of the murder, which by this point was 4 years ago, that she had seen a man climbing out of the window. But the police, very simply and very conveniently, just brushed off her story, saying that it had been the figment of a 9-year-old girl's imagination. Either that, or she dreamt it, or she was just lying for her mother. Pick your own. Pick your own story. They also claim that during their crime reconstructions, they found it near impossible for a grown man to climb through a similar door window.
What in the JonBenet?
I know. Like, I know.
Come on.
Shut up. And as for the recording of the emergency call, the prosecution sound analyst, a woman named Tuya Naimi, had concluded that there was no outsider's voice heard on the emergency call, nor was there the sound of anybody stepping on broken glass, fighting, or climbing out of a broken window. I'm sorry, is this just a phone that's in the kitchen, or is this a fucking high-power microphone? Shut the fuck up. It's honestly the lies and the manipulation that the police and the prosecution do in this case is unbelievable. But in the end, the district court agreed that the prosecution had shown with sufficient probability that there hadn't been an outsider in the house during the call. Which is bonkers, but that's what happened.
Hi, I'm Ashley Flowers, creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. Every Monday, me and my best friend Britt break down a new case, but not in the way you've heard before, and not the cases you've heard before. You'll hear stories on Crime Junkie that haven't been told anywhere else. I'll tell you what you can do to help victims and their families get justice. Join us for new episodes of Crime Junkie every Monday, already waiting for you by searching for Crime Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts.
It was also during this trial that Annalie learned what you have all probably worked out. Seppo wasn't the nice man that she thought he was. He was a honeypot undercover police officer sent to infiltrate Annalie's inner life and find out whether or not she was guilty. But Seppo had actually reported back that he didn't find anything incriminating about Annalie at all. As far as he could tell, she was a good mother and her kids loved her. And as for the phone tapping and the bugs in the house, they didn't give the police anything valuable either. But despite this humongous lack of evidence, three judges voted 2-1 that Annalie was guilty. Finnish trials have three judges, they don't have juries, and the majority of the judges win.
Yeah, which, like, I would say, before I read this, is a good system in some ways, right? If I was going to be tried, I'd rather have a jury trial rather than a bench trial, because I feel like you've got more people to convince, but they're lay people.
Mm.
You can confuse them with experts.
Yeah.
We've talked about this endlessly. You can just get an expert in to be like this, 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 and this, and people get confused. Judges, they know the law. They understand these things. It's going to be harder to pull the wool over their eyes. Not apparently in this fucking case.
So, on the 12th of November, Annalie was sentenced to life in prison.
As you can imagine, Annalie immediately filed for her sentence to be overturned in the Court of Appeals, which is the second stage of the Finnish court system. Her hearing took place in February 2011, 5 years after the murder. This time, Annalie's defence team commissioned their own analysis of the emergency call recording. Their sound expert concluded that it was impossible to say with certainty that there was not an outsider present solely based on the recording. They also had Amanda, so Annalie's daughter's, insistence that she had seen a man climbing out of the window, as well as a total lack of any murder weapon, and the bloody footprints and fibres found at the scene, which investigators had no explanation for. I mean, that alone, if you can't match those fibres to something else in the house, and they're all over him.
Mm.
So, based on all of this, thankfully, Annalie was acquitted of murder by unanimous decision in July 2011. But if you think that's the end of the story, you haven't looked at your little time bar.
So now Annalie was desperate to put the whole thing behind her and finally reunite with her children after having not seen them once since her arrest over a year before. Amanda, the eldest child, had been placed in foster care, but the other three were with Annalie's brother and his wife. But after Annalie's release, weeks passed without her being able to get in touch with social services or with her brother. And when Annalie did manage finally to speak with her brother, he said he'd taken the kids on a yacht trip for the holidays, so she'd have to wait until the end of summer to see them. He had bought the yacht using the 8,000 euros a month he was being paid to foster the children.
And at some point during this trip on the fucking yacht he's purchased with the foster money, the three kids, mainly the older boy, whose name we actually don't know because he's never been named in the media, began recounting some rather troubling stories to their uncle slash foster father. Ari, Annalie's brother, actually filmed the kids telling him stories of what had happened on the night of the murder. And their stories were filled with animal torture, sexual abuse, and ritual sacrifice. And the tapes were sent straight to the police, where investigators decided that the stories were serious enough to reopen the investigation into Yucca's murder, and more specifically, into Annalie. The eldest boy had claimed that he had been awake on the night of his father's murder and he had heard everything. This was despite having originally told police they had slept through it all, and also despite the fact that they ignore the eldest daughter, who was 9 at the time, and what she saw, but now they're willing to believe a child that was younger than her saying all of the crazy stuff he said. They really are just like, we're going to pick and choose what we listen to. So the boy now claimed that Annalie and 9-year-old Amanda had actually planned the murder of Yucca together and had even practiced it. The boy said that his mother and sister had murdered Yucca before making the emergency call and that they'd even recorded the murder with a tape recorder. He said that they had then played this recording back over the phone to make it sound as though Yucca was still alive at the time Annalie was talking to the operator. And he said that he'd heard all of this through his bedroom door.
In the video filmed by Ari, he and his wife then prompt the kids to tell them more. And this is where things get really wild. The kids said that their mother, Annalie, had regularly, physically and sexually abused them. The boy said that she would hogtie him and throw him down the stairs and even make him sit naked outside in the snow for hours as a punishment. The kids also said that Annalie would celebrate the anniversary of Yucca's murder by playing with his ashes. Annalie would then make the kids cut themselves and paint satanic pictures with their blood. According to the children, Annalie would even have them sacrifice animals as a part of these satanic rituals.
And if you think that's all pretty horrible, well, the stories just got worse and worse. Especially when the kids mentioned one of their mother's ex-boyfriends, a man named Jens Kucker. They alleged that Annalie and Jens would have sex together in front of them, and that when Kucker was done with their mum, he would occasionally anally rape them. The children also claimed that their eldest sibling Amanda, who would have been 11 at the time, had been enlisted to help in the abuse. Kucker would bring sex toys to the house, and the children claimed that Amanda would forcefully use them on her younger siblings. The final tape ended with the kids saying that they'd seen their mother and Amanda dancing naked in the garden wearing devil horns. Can we just talk about the fact that obviously this is some crazy satanic panic bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like, spoilers, that's what's going on here. Isn't it weird that, like, the kids always say really fucked up things. A, where do they get it? Obviously, they're being coached in some cases. But, like, they always say kind of similar things. Like, why is that? Like, where is this kind of sex and satanic abuse and animal torture and rape and all of that coming together in the minds of children that are still incredibly young? It's not like they must have been exposed to it somewhere, but it is curious that whatever country it's happening in, it's always very consistent. I'm not saying it's because it's true, just before anyone thinks that. I'm just saying it's very curious.
Well, the greatest trick ever pulled was the devil convincing us all he doesn't exist.
There you go. Must be that. Very, very strange behavior. And yeah, it's classic. And I think the thing you have to remember here, we're not talking here 70s, 80s, even 90s kind of satanic panic, like we've talked about many, many a time. This is in 2011.
So the following Friday evening, officers rushed into Annalie's house to search the premises. Annalie was expecting to have Amanda over that weekend, but police told her that Amanda had been taken to hospital, but refused to tell her why. At the hospital, Amanda was kept equally in the dark. Nurses scanned her entire body with UV lights looking for scars, and apparently they found a sort of cross-shaped one that matched a cut found on Yucca's body.
I'm sorry.
The man was stabbed 88 times.
I mean, fucking hell. I know. And also, like, scanning the body of a child looking for marks that she's involved in some sort of satanic ritual abuse. Is this the Middle Ages? What is going on? What the fuck is going on?
And also, a number of other tests were carried out, including one to check whether 15-year-old Amanda still had A hymen. Can we get over this, please? Oh my God, you can break your hymen riding a horse.
Also, it's so irrelevant to like what's going on. But also, how willing they were to put this 15-year-old child, who is now in foster care because her dad was murdered in front of her and her mother has been arrested for his murder and she's been separated from him. Like, the extent to which these police officers are willing to go in handling a traumatized family in order to get the verdict they want is sick.
But they concluded, after what I'm sure was quite an extensive examination, that Amanda did still have her hymen. But because it doesn't mean anything, it did absolutely nothing to stop the crazy train from leaving the platform. 3 months after being cleared of all murder charges, Annalee was once again arrested for the murder of her husband. Only now it was compounded with additional accusations of the sexual abuse of children. This time the district court hearings took place behind closed doors, away from the media. And the evidence that the police investigation presented was declared confidential for 60 years. So some of it won't be available for anyone to see until some point in the 2070s, where I plan to be long fucking dead.
And I'm also just like, yeah, what a sign of confidence in your case that you're like, no one can see this for 60 years. Why? Some sort of weird little crimey time capsule you're building? Or is it because you've got a shit case against this woman? But anyway, we don't know the full story, but this is what we do know. The court rejected the prosecution's allegation that the scars found on Amanda were proof of anything, as their origin couldn't be determined. But the court also rejected the defense's argument that the stories told by the children weren't credible. So the court's basically saying the stories told by the kids may well be legit. The court was seemingly swayed by the testimony of a doctor. This doctor said that it was possible that the girls' hymens had repaired themselves. So there was absolutely no evidence that they hadn't been horribly raped and satanically tortured, even though there is not one iota of evidence and there are no scars. There's nothing apart from one little cross-shaped scar on a 15-year-old girl. What 15-year-old child doesn't have a scar? It is absolutely mind-boggling, the journey that this story takes. So yeah, the doctor said that the intact hymens weren't proof that the girls hadn't been raped, and he stated that he had no reason to doubt the children's stories, apart from the massive lack of any sort of evidence. Now, obviously, you guys at home are most likely, hopefully, thinking exactly what we're thinking, that this is all, of course, some crazy satanic panic mania, and you would be right. But the police were going with it, full force.
Even though the timeline of these accusations of sexual abuse place full-time undercover cop, part-time Lothario Seppo in Annalee's and the kids' lives, he said absolutely nothing of the sort.
Yeah, so apparently all of this satanic ritual abuse is going on behind Seppo's back.
Right.
Even though he's a police officer. And basically, he's spending enough time with the family that he's asked them to move in with him.
And as we said, Seppo reported absolutely nothing weird at all. He only ever said that the kids loved Annalee and that she was a good mother and that he hadn't witnessed any antisocial behaviour whatsoever. And this is when another bombshell dropped. Let's talk about the foreign DNA that the police had found on the logs in the house. The DNA that, at the time, the police had compared to hundreds and hundreds of people and found no match for. Well, it just so happened that 7 years into this joke of an investigation, it was finally revealed that the DNA of this unknown male actually belonged to a police lab technician.
I have no words. I have no words.
But the prosecution just used this massive fuck-up to argue that there was now even less proof of an outside attacker being present at the house, and therefore Annalee was even more guilty.
It doesn't point to the fact that you completely fucked up the forensics and therefore you can't in any way say that there wasn't an external intruder. And even if there wasn't any DNA, it is in no way proof that there wasn't a third party in the house. Honestly, again, can I just remind everybody, this is in the 2000s and they're fucking this up this hard. But despite all of this, the court found Annalee and her ex-boyfriend, Jens, guilty of the sexual abuse of her children in a 2-1 decision without any evidence whatsoever. So yeah, all they've got are the statements made by some confused, traumatized children who have already suffered a huge loss when their father died and a massive upheaval when their mother was taken from them. And they're just like, yeah, sure, kids, whatever you say. I don't know. And also the other thing I want to point out about the statements is they're just made to Ari, their uncle, on a fucking yacht while he films them. They're not made to an expert. Mm-hmm. And they're not made in a clinical setting.
And also, Ari has a pretty large incentive to keep these children.
Yes.
In the shape of 8,000 euros a month.
Oh, yes.
But the crazy train has not only left the station, it is now tearing down the tracks at full speed. In June 2012, Annalie was sentenced to 7 years, and her ex-boyfriend was sentenced to 10. And when she appealed these charges, it completely backfired. And the Court of Appeals actually extended her sentence by a further 6 months.
And then Annalie was made to endure yet another trial for the murder of her husband. So she's in prison for the sexual abuse claims. Now they're putting her on trial again for the murder of Jukka. And that's because Finland, like the UK, doesn't have a double jeopardy law. But the main reason that Annalie was going back to court for Jukka's murder was because of the children's disturbing testimony. Not because of any like new or material evidence coming to light. And so the prosecution's version of events from the night more or less remained exactly the same as it had done at the first trial. Except with regards to the actual time that Jukka had been murdered and the reason. Because remember, now they've got the whole recording story from the kid.
So let's start with the timeline for the killing. Remember, the kids said that Annalie and Amanda had killed Jukka hours before and recorded it and then played it back when they called the emergency services to make it sound like the attack was still going on. The state sound analyst now claimed that it was indeed a tape recorder that was playing the sounds of Jukka being murdered, not that she should have known that first time round as an expert. And this sound analyst also testified that she found it suspicious that a 9-year-old Amanda had shouted, "Come quickly, my dad is hurt," on the call. She claimed that if there had been an intruder in the house, Amanda would have used a different statement.
Is she running some sort of body language and a linguistic YouTube channel?
I guess so, man.
I feel like this woman has watched too many true crime documentaries. Because just to be like, she would never have said that.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up. The defense psychologist obviously questioned how a sound analyst could have the competence to make such a judgment. Human behavior was not her area of expertise, after all. In fact, when questioned, it turned out that sound analysis wasn't even her area of expertise. This sound expert for the prosecution had a degree in phonetics and logopedics and no formal training whatsoever in sound technology.
So she just gag and talk about phonetics, basically.
Again, just comes back to what we alluded to before. I know this isn't a jury trial, but you know what I mean? Like, just getting an expert to say whatever the fuck you want. But despite all of this, and the fact that there was absolutely no solid evidence pinning Annalie as her husband's killer, she was found guilty of murder.
Again.
Again. And in December 2012, Annalie was sentenced to life in prison for the second time, now labelled a killer and a child sex abuser.
But once again, Annalie managed to have the murder conviction overturned in the Court of Appeals in February 2015. By a vote of 2-1. Not only did the judges find that there was no hard evidence to underpin the children's statements, but they also decided that a lack of solid evidence for an intruder didn't rule out the possibility of an outsider being responsible for Jukka's murder because they seemed to be reasonable people. Also, these judges found that there was not sufficient proof that Annalie had staged the crime scene. The prosecution escalated the case to the Supreme Court, claiming to have new evidence. But this was dismissed in December of 2015, and the courts upheld the not guilty verdict. Still, though, Annalie had to serve out her sentence for the bizarre sexual abuse conviction.
Yes, they've only overturned
the murder.
She's still in prison for the sexual abuse stuff. And she was finally released on the 3rd of June 2016 and put on probation after having served half her sentence for the sex abuse. That same year, the courts granted Annalie €500,000 in compensation for the 600 days she'd spent in prison for her husband's murder. It was the highest compensation ever paid to somebody for false imprisonment in Finland. Over 50 officers were also charged that year for trying to access Annalie's private information on the police database, but most just received a fine. Since her arrest, Annalie hasn't had any contact with her children, except for her eldest, Amanda. From beginning to end, Amanda stood by her mother and told her story that she saw a man climbing out of the window that night. She also vehemently denies that she or Anneli ever abused the other children.
And finally, after a mind-bending 17 years, in February this year, 2023, the truth finally came out. Anneli's three youngest children officially retracted their testimonies. In a new statement, they denied that their mother, her former boyfriend, or Amanda had ever sexually or physically abused them. Now, they claim that they had fabricated the stories entirely. They said that they had been coerced to do so by Anneli's brother, Ari, and his wife. Because the couple were making 8,000 euros a month, serious yacht money, from fostering them, so they didn't want them to go back to Anneli. And to keep that income stream flowing in, Anneli's own brother stooped low enough to destroy his sister's entire life. Today, despite the new statement, Anneli's guilty verdict for sexual abuse has yet to be overturned. Matti Tolvanen, a professor of criminal law at the University of Eastern Finland, has said this: if the Supreme Court does overturn Anneli and her ex-boyfriend's sexual abuse sentence, then it signals a serious moment of self-reflection for the Finnish legal system. And the fucking rest, Jesus.
I know, I feel like that's putting it very mildly. Yeah.
To this day, the murder of Jukka Lahti is still unsolved, and police are not actively investigating it because they're probably too embarrassed. And it remains one of Finland's most notorious and bewildering unsolved crimes. And they've got Lake Bodom, so that's quite high praise.
Honestly, this is bonkers. This story, like we said at the start, it really does have everything. And I think just the fact that it happened so not that long ago is unbelievable.
I mean, it's happening now.
Yeah, it's happening now. And poor, poor, poor Anneli. Like, it's rare that we come across somebody who has been a victim and then victimized and victimized and victimized and victimized again and again and again and again. So yeah, just really, really messy, messy, messy work. But that's the Ulvila case.
Pronounced beautifully by our resident linguistic expert.
Thank you very much. And if you're out there, Mr. Finnish immigration officer, done.
Cheers.
And we hope you guys enjoyed it. Go check out our shorthands if you have been sleeping on those. We're putting out some really, really great episodes. Go check those out on Amazon Music every single Tuesday without fail. And we'll be back next week for something else. Until then, goodbye.
Make me.
Hi, I'm Ashley Flowers, creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. Every Monday, me and my best friend Britt break down a new case, but not in the way you've heard before, and not the cases you've heard before. You'll hear stories on Crime Junkie that haven't been told anywhere else. I'll tell you what you can do to help victims and their families get justice. Join us for new episodes of Crime Junkie every Monday, already waiting for you by searching for Crime Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts.